Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we have two very special interviews for you. The first interview concerns the aging process. As baby boomers begin to age, they begin to reach for all sorts of quack cures as well as genuine therapies to help slow down the aging process and reinvigorate their aging bodies. So the first special guest today is Professor Jay Olshansky. He's at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and he's written several very interesting books about what is known and not known about the aging process. What works? What doesn't work? What is hokum and what is real science? That's what we're going to talk about today with Professor Jay Olshansky of the University of Illinois in Chicago. And speaking about health, some people say that one fountain of youth is already at hand, and that is good nutrition and exercise. In some sense, perhaps we already have a mini fountain of youth. And with us today to discuss nutrition is Margot Wittan of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Given the fact that Americans are getting heavier and heavier, it's become a national crisis. Because this, of course, will eventually translate into a larger medical bill. And in fact, in Germany, some politicians are saying that there should be, in some sense, to put it crudely, a fat tax. Because as people get larger and larger, they come down with more and more medical problems, and guess who winds up paying the bill? The taxpayer. So why not simply tax the people who are causing the problem in order to get them to rein in their behavior? Well, some people don't like it. Other people are saying maybe that's the way to go. At any rate, let's talk about two fountains of youth that we already have at hand, and that is exercise and, of course, a good, healthy diet. And we should also point out that starting September 1st, my new series on the Science Channel debuts, second season of Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible. Watch for it on the Science Channel starting September 1st at 9 p.m. Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible, based on my New York Times bestseller, Physics of the Impossible. And now I'd like to bring on our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Professor S.J. Olshansky. He's a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and he's also a research institute at the Center on Aging at the University of Chicago. Well, if you've been to the drugstore, you've probably been hit with all these advertising saying that you can retard the aging process, even roll back the hands of time, live longer, they say. But what about the truth? The truth about human growth hormone, antioxidants, massive doses of vitamins and minerals and herbs and supplements? What about the hardcore truth and scientific verification of these claims? And also, what about genetics? We seem to be teasing apart many of the genes that influence the aging process. So once again, we're going to bring on our special guest today, Professor Jay Olshansky, and he's the co-author of a book called The Quest for Immortality. So that's the subject of today's discussion, immortality. Now, I understand that today you and other prominent scientists have issued a policy statement, a recommendation of sorts that could have serious and beneficial economic benefits. Could you elaborate?
Yes. This is based on an article we published in The Scientist back in March of this year with Rich Miller from the University of Michigan, Dan Perry from the Alliance for Aging Research, and Bob Butler from the International Longevity Center in New York. And we basically suggested that the time has arrived for societies, not just the United States, but really all nations, to begin investing in an effort to slow the biological process of aging in people. And the logic and the rationale is fairly straightforward. Basically, what we're suggesting is that even a small deceleration or slowdown in the rate of biological aging of just a few years would actually yield huge economic and health benefits. I mean, think of it this way. The way the NIH is currently set up is essentially to deal with one disease at a time, independent of all others. But if you can find a way to slow down the biological process of aging, you would essentially postpone everything that is negative associated with growing older into later and later ages. It would be as if you achieved a major discovery for every major fatal and non-fatal disease if you could find a way to slow aging. So we're calling on Congress to begin investing in a concerted effort to slow the biological process of aging in people.
Yes, in fact, the social benefits could be astronomical, especially as you look at the baby boomers that are hitting 60 and will eventually increase medical costs tremendously in this country.
Yes, I mean, the prevalence of conditions of frailty and disability will rise dramatically in the coming decades with the aging of the baby boom cohort. So slowing that process even a little bit would actually enable people to be healthier longer, contribute to the economy longer. They would just everything positive associated with aging. There are positive things associated with aging. Would be extended. So it would be an extraordinarily important event for national economies, for public health. The time has arrived, I think. And not only has the time arrived, but the science is approaching the level at which I think we're beginning to gain enough understanding that we think we can do this in humans. We know we can do it in other animals. We think we can do this in humans.
Okay, now let's get back to Earth and talk about hokum, snake oil, and real science. If you visit the drugstore, you realize that there are whole shelves full of herbs and remedies and vitamins making all sorts of promises about retarding the aging process, reversing the years. So let's now talk about the science, that is, what is known experimentally. Let's start with the Internet, where we have lots of advertisements for human growth hormone. Now, in some sense, are the people of America being used as guinea pigs for this gigantic experiment on human growth hormone, or what are your thoughts?
Well, people are using themselves as guinea pigs. It's absolutely remarkable that, you can go on the Internet and find every conceivable nutritional supplement and hormone, including growth hormone, with people with no expertise in the field claiming that it can slow, stop, or reverse the biological process of aging. And people believe this. They spend enormous sums of money. They order this stuff over the Internet. They inject themselves with it or take these pills. And there isn't a shred of evidence that it'll make you live any longer. There actually is some evidence, some suggestive evidence, that some of these substances, including growth hormone, have the potential to actually shorten your life. So it's remarkable that people are conducting a biological experiment on themselves. It doesn't mean that there isn't value necessarily to some nutritional supplements, particularly for people who are deficient in certain vitamins and minerals. There's no question that there is a benefit for those individuals. But if your diet is so bad that you're deficient in some major vitamin or mineral or something, these vitamin supplements aren't going to make up the difference. It simply isn't going to work. And there's no evidence that it actually extends life.
And what about the side effects of human growth hormones? Some people think maybe cancer or other kinds of diseases associated with accelerating metabolism. It's like a sports car. If you were to accelerate a sports car, you throw off a few gears here and there. And that, of course, means cancer, because cancer, in some sense, is genetic errors. But what are your thoughts about side effects of human growth hormone?
Well, first of all, it has been demonstrated that there are some benefits, believe it or not, associated with growth hormone, including increased muscle mass and reduction in the rate of bone loss and improved skin elasticity. So you can't deny the fact that there have been benefits associated with it. But accompanying those benefits have been risks, including carpal tunnel syndrome, increased risk of diabetes. There is suggestive evidence that it might increase the risk of cancer. The fact is that it hasn't been properly studied yet using clinical trials in humans. And so before those clinical trials are in, before we know what the results are, it's really premature to be using these kinds of substances. And again, once again, with the case of growth hormone, there isn't any evidence that it extends life.
Okay, now moving on, when you go to the drugstore, you see these advertisements for mega vitamins. Some claim that it retards the oxidation process. Other people cite certain studies which show that if you ingest certain diets rich in vitamins, it seems to be good for you. But what about the pure form of vitamins that you buy in the drugstore?
Well, once again, the nutritional supplement industry is really working hard to convince us that aging is somehow caused by either the loss of some hormone or the lack of nutritional supplements of one kind or another, and they're perfectly willing to sell you everything that they can to try to convince you that you can somehow influence this process. And it's based in part on science, where it's suggested that that aging is influenced by oxidation, and this oxidation process can be slowed down in theory with the ingestion of certain nutritional supplements that have antioxidative effects. But there isn't any empirical evidence that demonstrates that these substances actually extend duration of life. So once again, it's the same scenario where people are selling something with exaggerated claims, with a profit motive in mind, and people are buying it up like crazy.
And what about herbs? Some people say that maybe pure vitamins that are refined by the chemical companies may not simulate vitamins in the natural forms. So what about taking herbal medicines? What is known or not known about herbs?
Now, honestly, I don't know that much about herbs and herbal medicines to comment on that. But what I can tell you is that there's plenty of evidence that eating more fruits and vegetables and can certainly lower your risk of a wide variety of diseases and disorders. And, of course, those in the supplement industry are suggesting that contained within those fruits and vegetables there are certain substances that they can concentrate in a pill and give to you in a larger form, you know, under the assumption that more is better. Well, there is where the evidence is lacking. The evidence is there that eating more fruits and vegetables is good for you. The evidence is lacking that the nutritional supplements containing the vitamins that they think are causing the beneficial effect, the evidence there is lacking that will have any significant effect.
Okay, now moving on, let's talk about something that actually does work. I think all scientists would say unanimously that there is one and only one proven way, in the animal kingdom anyway, of actually increasing the lifespan of animals. We don't know whether it works for humans yet. But let's talk about caloric restriction. First of all, what is it, and what tests have been done?
Well, you're right. This is the one intervention that's been demonstrated repeatedly to extend duration of life on a wide variety of species. It's basically reducing your caloric intake. It can, you know, vary. The percentage can vary from anywhere from 10 to 30% below maintenance levels. So it would depend on what your current height and weight is, but you know, if your normal caloric intake is 2,000 calories to maintain your weight, you might be reducing it down to 1,500 calories. And no one exactly knows why it works or how it works, the underlying mechanism, but there is consistent research suggesting that it extends duration of life. Now, the question is, how does it do so? Does it extend duration of life by slowing the biological process of aging? Some people believe that to be the case. Others suggest that it actually extends duration of life by reducing the risk of a wide variety of diseases and disorders, which is not the same as slowing the biological process of aging. Remember, if you reduce the risk of heart disease, cancer, and stroke, however you do that, through exercise or diet, the aging process marches on. It's uninfluenced by that. But if indeed you're slowing down the biological process of aging, then everything negative associated with it is dragged to later ages. It's postponed to later ages. And that would actually be a wonderful thing if caloric restriction was the mechanism that actually worked. Now, don't expect, by the way, that people are going to be living longer by dramatically reducing their caloric intake. What the scientists are looking for is the underlying mechanism to find a way to mimic that process without actually reducing your caloric intake. It should be obvious, by the way, that in the United States and elsewhere, we're doing the exact opposite. We are increasing our caloric intake. We are growing more obese at a more rapid pace than we ever have in the past. So this research is particularly important and is interesting for a wide variety of reasons.
Okay, now caloric restriction works on yeast cells, spiders, insects, mice, and now for the first time we're getting the first preliminary evidence from primate studies done in Bethesda, Maryland. So can you tell us a little bit about some of those experiments, because primates, of course, are closer to us, and perhaps it may work on organisms as complex as us. But what are your thoughts?
Well, my guess is it probably will. I mean, the work of Richard Weinrich from Wisconsin and other researchers at NIH at Bethesda have, I think, demonstrated quite convincingly that reducing caloric intake can lower the risk of disease. Probably it will extend duration of life. We have to wait for these animals to live long enough to determine whether or not that's going to be one of the consequences. But there are a couple of problems here. In some of the earlier studies, you need to remember that the control animals that were used in the caloric restriction studies were fed ad libitum, meaning they had as much food as they wanted, which is sort of like us. And so whenever you reduce your caloric intake relative to eating as much as you want, what you are demonstrating is more the detrimental effect of a gluttonous lifestyle rather than the longevity-enhancing effect of caloric restriction. So you have to be careful on how you interpret that. Now, in more recent studies, the control animals are not fed ad libitum. They are fed really more of a maintenance diet. And you're not seeing quite the large differences in duration of life in these two populations when you do it that way. Nevertheless, you do see reductions in the risk of a wide variety of diseases and disorders, and we would all be better off if we reduced our caloric intake. Whether it would work in humans at the level that we see in these other species, I think, is highly questionable. And there's a real concern when, for example, you extend the duration of life of a fruit fly or a roundworm nematode by 3, 4, or 5-fold. It's real tempting for researchers to then multiply the human life expectancy by 3, 4, or 5. And suggest that the same effect, if it occurred in humans, would make us live hundreds and hundreds of years. My guess is we wouldn't see anywhere near that kind of increase in magnitude and duration of life in humans. But if we could, you know, live healthier longer for just, you know, an extra 5 or 10 years, that would be huge.
Okay, now I understand that the animals that have been studied seem to be a little bit lethargic because they have such a restricted diet. They have less cancerous tumors, less incidences of diseases associated with the aging process, but they also seem to lack an interest in the sex drive. That is all the things that make life worth living, joie de vivre. These animals seem to be pretty lethargic. Is that true?
Yeah, so I understand that there appears to be a price to pay. There appears to be lower fecundity, less interest in sex, and I think a difficult problem with controlling body temperature. These animals are cold. In fact, feel cold. And in fact, in the case of humans who are conducting this experiment on themselves, they're essentially reporting the same thing. So there is a price, at least for now, to be paid by adopting this calorically restricted diet, which is why, as I suggested earlier, reducing your caloric intake to these kinds of levels probably isn't the way it's going to work in humans. The way it's probably going to work in humans is that scientists will try to find some sort of mimetic, something that will fool the body into believing that it's calorically restricted to achieve the same effect without actually significantly reducing your caloric intake like that. And that's probably the way it will work, and it's extremely valuable and interesting research that needs to be aggressively pursued because there's such great potential there.
Okay, now let's leave the animal kingdom and talk strictly about humans. In your book, you mentioned the fact that the life expectancy for Americans at the beginning of the 20th century was not very long at all, less than 50 years of age. And yet there's been an increase into the 70s since then. Some people think it's sanitation. Other people think it's antibiotics and vaccines. But what are your thoughts about looking at the long-term life expectancy of humans going back to ancient days, through the Middle Ages, to the turn of the century, to present-day times?
Well, going back to ancient times, there's evidence to suggest that life expectancy, for example, during the time of the ancient Egyptians, was probably somewhere in the 20s. Nobody knows exactly where it was, but it's likely to have been in the 20s. We achieved a very small incremental increase over the millennia to the beginning of the 19th and 20th centuries, when life expectancy rose up to about between 45 and 50, in the United States anyway. And then you saw this quantum leap in life expectancy during the 20th century from 50 to close to 80. And that was largely attributable to dramatic reductions in early age mortality, infant, child, and maternal mortality, principally as a result of sanitation, public health, refrigeration, foods, and so forth. The introduction of antibiotics occurred after most of the declines in the death rates occurred at younger ages and contributed relatively a small amount to the rise in life expectancy in the 20th century. Now, in the latter part of the 20th century, there have been notable reductions in death rates at middle and older ages, even from heart disease, from some forms of cancer. And so you see, two forces contributing during the 20th century, the early age mortality declines at the beginning and the later age mortality declines at the end, which explains, by the way, why the more recent increases in life expectancy have been smaller than the ones that occurred at the beginning of the 20th century. When you save children from dying, you add very rapidly to life expectancy. When you save middle-aged and older people from dying from fatal diseases, chronic fatal diseases, you add a relatively smaller amount.
Now, it turns out that Japanese women have some of the longest life expectancies on the planet Earth. It's almost approaching 90. So we're talking about 50% of Japanese women essentially getting into their late 80s and into their 90s. Some people say it's diet, a fish diet that's low in fat. But what are your thoughts about the demographics of different societies?
Well, first of all, for Japanese women, it's just above 85. It might be approaching 86. And, mm-hmm. and you have to realize that there's a huge difference between 85 and 90. It's not the same as between 50 and 55. And the reason is fairly straightforward. To raise life expectancy up when you're at these very high levels is extremely difficult because you're pushing up against the basic biological process of aging itself. There's no question that subgroups of the population, such as those in Okinawa, Japan, for example, have much higher life expectancies. The actual force involved is not yet understood. It's not like we can, here in the U.S., adopt the lifestyle of the Japanese. I know some people have suggested this, including some friends of mine who study the Okinawa diet, have suggested that you can somehow get Americans to live as long as the Okinawans by adopting this particular lifestyle. And there's no evidence to suggest that that would be the case unless, of course, we were all Japanese here in the United States, and that isn't the case. There are genetic factors that are influencing the risk of death and duration of life, and those are things that we simply cannot control, at least not yet anyway. But there's no question that subgroups of the population do experience greater longevity than other subgroups, and that is a fascinating area to study, by the way, because it would appear as though there are genes that exist within the human genome that influence duration of life, and they may be more highly concentrated in some subgroups relative to others.
Okay, now let's talk about genes, because that's, of course, where most of the breakthroughs are being made in the last few years. Again, there's no fountain of youth. No one in the genetics area is claiming to have solved the aging process, but there's been lots of very interesting studies. First of all, there's something called progeria, a genetic disease that's been intensely studied in which children die of old age. They look like plucked chickens, and they die of heart attacks as teenagers. Could you elaborate on that very strange disease?
Well, it appears on this, progeria appears on the surface anyway to be a phenomenon of accelerated aging, but there's evidence to suggest it is not. There are lots of things that don't occur in these children that occur in the aging phenotype of individuals who actually do make it out to older ages. So I would be cautious about thinking of progeria as accelerated aging. It is certainly interesting to study these individuals, and you have to realize that it's always easy to do something to yourself that will accelerate aging. I mean, you know, we do it all the time, quite frankly. And one of my the arguments that I've made for many years is that the only control we have over the duration of our life is to shorten it. And we exercise that control all the time when we adopt lifestyles that are, where we expose ourselves to the sun, or we don't exercise, or we smoke cigarettes, or use drugs. These are the kinds of things that can make us die at much younger ages than would otherwise be the case. Clearly, with these children with progeria, there are genetic forces that are influencing this phenomenon, but it is not, or appears not to be, a case of accelerated aging.
Now let me ask you a key question. Is there an age gene or a collection of genes which control the aging process?
Well, this, to me, is one of the most fascinating lines of research in the field of aging today. Clearly, we have people who live past 100, they're called centenarians, and people who live past 110, they're called supercentenarians. There are many fewer of the latter. But they do exist, and these individuals somehow can make it out for 100 years or 110 years without heart disease or cancer, while the rest of us don't live that long. And 3/4 of the population will die from heart disease, cancer, or stroke. So clearly, these individuals possess genes that enable them to combat the things that kill the rest of us at younger ages. And so the research that's ongoing now by a number of scientists that study these older individuals, I think, holds great potential for understanding the basic genetics of duration of life. It's important to remember that the genes that these individuals have are not, I hesitate to call them longevity genes, only because they can't exist for the purpose of making us live longer. But these individuals may just be fortunate to possess these genes that somehow protect them from the things that kill the rest of us at younger ages.
I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest has been Professor Jay Olshansky of the University of Illinois at Chicago, author of a new book called The Quest for Immortality. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Dr. Margot Boutin of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, talking about nutrition, dieting, and what's good for you. Once again, if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And check out my website. It's www.mkaku.org. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we begin a discussion about the aging process with Professor Jay Olshansky of the University of Illinois in Chicago. And the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about health, nutrition, exercise with Margaret Wittan of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. And also, once again, on September 1st, 9 p.m. at night, the second season of Sci-Fi Science begins on the Science Channel. And I'm the host of 12 episodes, once again, starting September 1st at 9 o'clock on the Science Channel. Watch for it. Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible, based on my New York Times bestseller, Physics of the Impossible. So let's now continue with the second half of Exploration. Well, on Exploration today, in the first half, we featured Professor Jay Olshansky of the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois in Chicago, talking about the aging process. In the second half of Exploration now, we bring on Dr. Margaret Wittan, Director of Nutrition Policy at the Center for Science in the Public Interest, an organization that was inspired by Ralph Nader. And we're going to talk about nutrition. What's good for you? What should be on your kitchen table? What about the obesity epidemic? What about vitamins and antioxidants? So all the questions that people have about nutrition we'll discuss on this segment of Exploration. Now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Dr. Margaret Wittan. She's the Director of Nutrition Policy for the Center for Science in the Public Interest based in Washington, D.C., an organization that was inspired by Ralph Nader, an organization that's been at the forefront of trying to put healthy foods on the agenda. And recently, that organization made headlines when they sued Kentucky Fried Chicken concerning trans fats in that restaurant menu. So today, we are going to talk about the obesity crisis in the United States. Is it possible to root out obesity, this coming health crisis, by changing the menu in school cafeterias, by changing the advertisements that we see on television, by changing the restaurant menus that we see all around us? Is it possible to control this emerging health crisis? Because in the coming years, we're going to see an explosion in obesity rates, in type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and any number of diseases that are linked to being overweight. So once again, our special guest today is Dr. Margaret Wittan, Director of Nutrition Policy for the Center for Science in the Public Interest in Washington, D.C. The first question for you is, tell us a little bit about the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
CSPI is located in Washington, D.C. We are a nonprofit organization concerned about health issues. We mostly work on issues related to food, nutrition, and food safety. And we have members all over the country.
And you've been around for several years, right?
CSPI has been around for 35 years. This is actually our 35th anniversary year. And so my boss, Michael Jacobson, has been at this for some time.
And I understand that you have roots with Ralph Nader.
Well, not very deep roots. Mike was an intern with Ralph Nader many, many years ago. But we otherwise don't have any close affiliates. But we do look at that model of advocacy and our watchdog group around food and nutrition issues.
Okay. Well, let's get right into health issues, specifically with regards to school children. I understand the organization recently came out with a report stating that, quote, 23 states get failing grade on the Center for Science and Public Interest school's food report card. So tell us a little bit about how the states are doing with regards to how, these large food companies are allowing high-fat diets to come into the schools.
Well, unfortunately, as a country, we're not doing that well on getting junk food out of schools. You've probably seen a lot of headlines in the last year about states that have improved their school nutrition policies in California and Connecticut and New Jersey. But those seem to be the exception rather than the rule. Still, about two-thirds of the states in the country have very weak policies that let too much soda and junk food into schools.
Now, I understand that Kentucky was given an A-. What does Kentucky do that the other states don't do?
It's true. The state of Kentucky has the strongest school nutrition policies in the country. They don't allow any food to be sold outside of the school meal programs up until after the lunch periods are over. And then after lunch, through the end of the day, they have strong nutrition standards for the kinds of foods that can be sold. So they set limits on portion size of saturated fat and salt for snacks. And they only allow healthy drinks like low-fat milk, water, real fruit juice, and low-sugar drinks to be sold for the rest of the school day.
Okay, and Nevada, Arkansas, New Mexico, and Alabama and California receive B pluses, but that's a very small list of states that get passing grades. 23 states received Fs, right?
You know, 23 states don't have any state nutrition standards for school food. They just follow the policy that's set by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and that national policy is really weak. It's out of date. It's was put into effect back in the 1970s, and it doesn't really address the key nutritional concerns of today. You know, it only really deals with the lack of vitamins and minerals. It doesn't deal with saturated and trans fat, sodium, or even calories in food. So those national standards that are in place really need to be updated. We've been working with parents and health organizations around the country on a bill that's been introduced by Senators Harkin and Murkowski. And it's a very good bill that would have USDA update its nutrition standards for foods that are sold out of vending machines, a la carte school stores, and other venues on school campuses for the whole school day.
And what do you say to the food industry who says that children should have a right to eat what they want? And, well, that's what kids want. They want to load up on sugar and fats. What do you say to the food industry?
I say shame on them for taking advantage of the budget problems that schools are facing and undermining children's diets and health, and also undermining parents who are trying to do the right thing and feed their children a healthy diet. You know, we parents shouldn't have to worry about whether or not our kids are spending their lunch money on flaming Cheetos and a Coke instead of on a balanced school meal. And it's time for Congress to stand with parents instead of with Coke and Pepsi and the snack food industry, and get junk food and soda out of schools.
Okay, well, in the past year, California, Connecticut, and New Jersey made headlines for bumping soda out of the schools, but yet these states do not really get such great grades when you look at the entire menu that's available to kids, right?
Well, those states have made progress, and I think the bills that have been passed in California, the policies in New Jersey and Connecticut and other places, they've made a step toward getting junk food out of schools. It's just their work is not quite done yet.
Okay. Now, also, let's talk about marketing to children in general, not just in the school environment. But when kids come home, let's say on Saturday morning when they watch the cartoons, they're bombarded, literally bombarded every few minutes with very sugary foods. And so what about the larger picture of what happens outside the schoolyard?
You know, unfortunately, our kids are painted this picture of what they should eat and what they should want to eat by the food industry, which is really skewed toward unhealthy foods, that the food industry spends about $10 billion a year influencing children's food habits. And that in and of itself isn't such a bad thing. The problem is that almost exclusively the foods that are marketed to kids are unhealthy. They're fast food, sugary drinks, candy, snack foods, and other foods that undermine children's diets.
Okay, and what do you say to, again, the food industry who says that the kids don't want to eat healthy foods? Healthy foods are boring. Who wants to drink tomato juice all day? The food industry would say that kids should have a choice. So what do you say to that argument again?
Kids should have choices in school, but all those choices should be healthful. And with marketing, I think it's fine for companies to make whatever products they want, but they shouldn't be going behind parents' backs and aggressively marketing unhealthy foods to kids. Kids aren't born with an innate desire to eat McDonald's hamburgers. you know, that desire comes from $1 billion worth of marketing that McDonald's spends trying to get people to want to come to McDonald's and eat their products. That kids will like healthy foods, will eat healthy foods if they're available, attractive, you know, packaged nicely, put the cartoon characters on the healthy foods instead of the unhealthy foods, and if they're affordably priced so that parents can buy them. So I think it's a myth that kids will only eat junk food. I know just a couple of weeks ago I did a little nutrition lesson in my daughter's classroom. She's in second grade, and the kids tasted lots of different fruits and vegetables and really liked them. And every single fruit or vegetable that I brought was gone by the end of the lesson.
Okay, and let's be specific now. What are some of the worst offenders? Like, for example, Coca-Cola and soda in general. Isn't that basically just sugar water?
Well, actually, we've gotten to a point now where soda is the biggest source of calories in American diets. So people are getting more calories from just soda pop than they're getting from real food. So this is a very big problem in American diets, in adult diets, and especially in children's diets. And I think we need to put soda back into its proper place in the diet. Instead of drinking it all the time, it should just be an occasional treat. It doesn't mean the kids should never drink soda, but they don't need to have access to it 24 hours a day, every place they are, including in school.
Okay. Also, we've heard a lot of fats in school diets. What about trans fats? What are they?
Trans fats are a kind of fat that are mostly created when vegetable oil is hydrogenated into shortening or margarine. And unfortunately, these fats raise blood cholesterol and increase the risk of heart disease. They're found mostly in fried foods like French fries and chicken nuggets and other foods that are deep fat fried. They're also found in pastries and crackers and cookies. And while the packaged food industry has been working hard to reduce the amount of trans fat in foods, restaurants still have way too much trans fat. And so I think we need to work with the food industry to get most of the trans fat out of our diet.
But is all fats bad? What about like olive oil and those people who promote the Mediterranean diet? Are we talking about all fats being taken off the kitchen table, or some of the fats are worse than other fats?
Well, you have to watch your total fat intake because of calories. You know, fat is very calorically dense. It packs a lot of calories into smaller amounts of food. So you need to watch your fat intake just to help you watch your calories. But most importantly when it comes to fats is you have to watch out for the bad fats, the saturated fats and the trans fats, which clog arteries and cause heart disease. Those are the ones you really want to limit. So that means cutting back on whole milk, cheese, and, you know, full-fat ice cream that are high in saturated fat, choosing leaner cuts of meat because meats can also be high in saturated fat, watching out for fried foods because many of them are fried in partially hydrogenated oil, which is not only high in trans fat, but also saturated fat. So watching the type of fats you eat is especially important.
Okay, now let's talk about restaurants, because a lot of people like to eat out, and baby boomers, of course, have a little bit of disposable income and love to get out of the kitchen. However, when you go to a restaurant, there's nothing on the menu that tells you what is going to clog your arteries and add to a bulge around your midriff versus what foods are good for you. So what are you supposed to do?
Well, it's true that we are choosing more and more to let restaurants do the cooking. And, you know, as a working mom, I think that can be a good thing. The problem is that when we eat out, restaurants aren't providing nutrition information, and they are providing huge portion sizes. So people are usually eating a lot more food than they think. It's not uncommon for restaurant entrees to have 1,000 calories in just the entree, so about a half a day's worth of calories. And once you add in side dishes and a drink or an appetizer, it's pretty easy to eat a whole day's worth of calories in a single sitting at a restaurant without even realizing it. So we've been working with state legislatures and cities and with Congress on legislation that would require chain restaurants to list calories right on the menu board so that people could make their own choices, you know, so that people could tell the difference between a tuna salad sandwich and a roast beef. sandwich. You know, the tuna salad actually has about 50% more calories and twice as much saturated fat as a roast beef sandwich. Without calorie labeling on the menus, there's no way to know that.
And so some kind of truth in labeling law, you think, would be good towards forcing the large chains and also restaurants to be honest about what they're serving?
Absolutely. People have a right to this information. And, you know, people who have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or diabetes, they need this information. It's a matter of life and death. You know, it's a matter of being able to manage their diseases. Without that information, there's just no way to know what you're getting. You know, people oftentimes go into Starbucks or another coffee shop and get a coffee and a pastry and think they're just having a little snack, but walk out with a half a day's worth of calories.
And now the industry would say that it just costs too much to do that. And for example, if you go to a French restaurant, you sort of expect to have rich sauces. If you go to an Italian restaurant, you expect to have lots of cheese. So what do you do when the industry says that fat is commonly found in French and Italian cooking?
Well, what we're pushing for is calories to be listed on the menus at chain restaurants where they have standardized menus and standardized recipes where it will be possible for them to provide the information. And it doesn't cost that much to provide the information. About half of the big chain restaurants in the country already have the information. But instead of hiding it on a website, which is very inconvenient for people to access before going out to eat, we ask that they just take those numbers and put them on the menu where people can see them and use them.
Okay, so if you walk into a fast food restaurant, what is the worst? I mean, what about fried chicken? Chicken, of course, has less of these animal fats than, let's say, red meat. But what's good and what's not so good when you walk into a fast food restaurant?
Well, you know, in restaurants, it's anyone's guess what are the best choices. It really depends on how the food is prepared and what the size of the portions are. You know, a parent sitting down at a chain restaurant might think that the chicken tenders are a better choice than the baby back ribs on the kids' menu for their kids. But in fact, the ribs have fewer calories because the once you fry the chicken, it's no better than, you know, than the ribs are. So I think oftentimes people who are even trying to make the right choices can't because they don't have the information that they need. At a fast food restaurant, a large chocolate shake at McDonald's actually has more calories than a meal of a hamburger, French fries, and a Coke.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Because it's so big and just has so many calories in it. So, you know, how's a person supposed to know that?
Yes, how is a person supposed to know that when they order French fries and hamburgers and onion rings and things like that? And these are part of the American diet, right?
We have to change the way we think about food. And there are times to splurge, and we should enjoy those foods. But we need to get to a way of eating that is better for our health, that tastes good, and that is affordable. You know, healthy eating can taste terrific. And it doesn't have to be, we don't have to have this, you know, antagonism between good taste and health, that there are lots of really good-tasting, healthy foods that people could make at home, could buy in the grocery store, could get at restaurants, if the food industry helps us to do that.
Okay, now let me ask you a very broad, general question about diet books. There are lots and lots of them, but isn't it true that for a lot of them, they only work short-term, and they don't really take the pounds off permanently, and that would require lifestyle changes rather than a quick fix? But what are your opinions about diet crazes?
You know, there's no quick fix for watching your weight. It does require a change in lifestyle. Basically just eating fewer calories and being more physically active. And, you know, some of these diet books give you gimmicks that allow you to track your calories for a short period of time. But, you know, most of these diets are not sustainable over a lifetime. So as soon as you go off the diet, you're going to return back to your starting weight and sometimes even gain a little extra along the way. So we do need to think about healthy eating in a way that you can stick with for the rest of your life. And I think that means changes in the way we educate children in schools, you know, having more nutrition education. It means more investment in the Centers for Disease Control and in programs to promote healthy eating and physical activity. It means calorie labeling on menus in chain restaurants so people can make informed choices when they eat out, which is about a third of our calories. We need to stop junk food marketing aimed at kids to affect the way kids think about food. We need to get the junk food out of schools so that parents' efforts to feed their kids aren't undermined. You know, that healthy eating is a personal choice, but it's also affected by politics and economics and a lot of outside influences. And we need to deal with some of those influences to make it easier for Americans to eat well. Most people want to eat better. They just find it really hard to do that.
Now, a few years ago, there was a monster bestseller. A French woman said that there is a secret that keeps French women thin. The French diet has lots of creamy sauces, and so French women should be like balloons, but there they are, svelte and fashionable. And if you read the very back of the book, you find the secret of the French women, and that is that French portions are smaller than American portions. What are your thoughts? Are European portions really smaller and American portions much larger, and is that contributing to the obesity crisis?
Smaller portions mean smaller waistlines. I think the portion sizes really make a big difference. And, you know, food companies in the United States have really aggressively used value marketing to try to sell their products and to get people to come to their restaurants. So they offer, you know, bigger and bigger portions and position those as being a better value. And that has really contributed significantly to the rising obesity rates. We're just eating a lot more calories than in the past.
Okay, and also let's talk about the crisis in the American, body politic. We're talking about Americans ballooning. How bad is this crisis? One-third, I've seen some reports that say up to one-third of Americans could be obese. What are your thoughts about what's happening with the American public and what we can do about it? Because this is going to cause a lot of medical problems in the future.
Obesity is one of the fastest rising and most significant health problems facing the country. As you said, about a third of Americans are obese, but two-thirds of Americans are overweight enough that it puts their health at risk. And we're now at a point where a third of our kids are either overweight or obese. This is a big problem. It affects a lot of Americans. It's a fast-rising problem. We've gotten to this point over the last 25 years or so, and it's already having a very negative effect on Americans' health. We've seen a 60% increase in diabetes rates over the last 10 years. So many kids have type 2 diabetes that we no longer can even call the disease adult-onset diabetes, that it contributes to heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and a number of health problems which not only affect Americans' quality of life but are really putting a strain on government budgets, on the budgets of many big corporations which are complaining about high health care costs. This is a very important, costly problem to the country, and we're doing very little to address it.
I was watching CNN TV last week, and they said that this obesity crisis is comparable to 9/11. 9/11, of course, was this sudden shock that jolted people's thinking. However, this obesity crisis is different. It's slow. It kind of creeps up on you because we are talking about people's choices that they make. But eventually, it could break the bank in terms of depleting our coffers that are increasingly being used to treat medical problems. Do you think it's on that scale that at some point we have to realize that it's going to break the bank?
Absolutely. About 112,000 people die from obesity each year. That's the equivalent of a jetliner full of 300 people crashing and dying every single day. If we had a plane crashing every day, you better believe that the country would be mobilized to do something about airline safety, whereas when people, you know, die quietly from heart disease and cancer and diabetes, it goes unnoticed. And as a country, we're doing very little. One example is the Centers for Disease Control has an obesity prevention program. It's Division of Nutrition and Physical Activity. And Congress has increased the funding for that program over the last several years. But still, CDC is only able to fund 28 states for nutrition, physical activity, and obesity programs. Still, many states don't have any program at all. And the states that are funded, many of them are funded at very low levels where they're only able to pull together a coalition and develop a state plan, but not really do much programming in a state. So, you know, even that basic prevention program at CDC, we're making very little investment in it as a country.
Well, then the question is, who's at fault? Some people would point the finger at people's choices, that they're self-indulgent, they don't exercise enough, and we're becoming a nation of fatties. Other people say, no, it's the food industry. They've been dragging their feet. They're not being truthful to the American people. They've been glossing over these problems, and they've been, of course, packaging and marketing these things aggressively. So where do you think the fault really lies, or does it lie in a multiple of areas?
Obesity is a societal problem, and I think we're going to need to come together as a society to address it. There's plenty of blame to go around. I think certainly ultimately it's up to individuals to decide what they're going to eat and up to parents to decide what to feed their families. But it's hard to exercise personal responsibility in our junk food, couch potato culture. You know, as a mom, I can try hard to feed my daughter a healthy diet, but she spends a lot of her time at school, and so we also need to have healthy foods at school. She watches some TV on the weekend where she's bombarded with lots of ads for junk food, which cause her to want to eat certain foods, not even just to want to eat, but expect that that's the way that kids eat. People go out to eat more and more. You know, how can you exercise personal responsibility if you don't even have basic nutrition information so that you can make an informed choice? So I think we all need to do our part as individuals, as parents. Companies need to make healthy foods. They need to package them attractively, price them competitively, and market them. You know, for example, at a fast food restaurant, it's not enough to just offer a salad. There need to be other healthy choices, and that salad can't cost four times as much as a Big Mac and, you know, expect to compete.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our first guest in the first half hour was Dr. Jay Olshansky of the University of Illinois at Chicago in the School of Public Health, speaking about what is known and not known about the aging process. And then in the second half of Exploration, we talked about nutrition, what's good for you on the dinner table and what's not. And our special guest was Dr. Marga Wootan, Director of Nutrition Policy at the Center for Science for Public Interest in Washington, D.C. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City University of New York. Check out my website. It's www.mkaku.org. mkaku.org. And so far we've logged over 110 million page hits on that website. So once again, thank you for listening to Exploration.